And it's also some of the most important verses in the text, and quite difficult to understand some of it. And also, it's we could say some of the most essential instructions in the text. As regards the third point, to yesterday we had the first two under the 6 points regarding the ground or the support for achieving non-conceptual original wisdom. And the third point is what is called the application, the four applications. And the root verse for that is as follows. As regards application authentic in its mode, there are four degrees of engagement in this as well. Application involving something to focus on, application involving nothing to focus on, application devoid of focus or serving as focus, and application whose focus is nothing to focus on. So, Rinpoche's commentary on this was that it's not possible to gain realization of pure being directly, immediately. That is to say, in most cases, one would need to go through a stepwise process in terms of the four steps that are described here. It is possible for, in very rare cases, for realization of pure being or the absolute nature to be attained immediately, instantaneously. Same word, trunang, instead of translating as delusory appearance, one could say projection. A projection of what? Projection of the habitual patterns in one's own mind, appearing as dualistic appearance, and therefore being assumed to be dualistic appearance. And this is what makes them into phenomena. It's what gives them the character of binding one in samsara, because one thinks they exist separately from the perceiver, instead of understanding that they are like the appearances in dream, where it's semnang nime, where mind and appearance are not two different things. So that point you should think about very, very well, this term semnang nime. Mind and appearance are not two. You might write that, if I were you, I'd write that phrase down and reflect over it well. Semnang nime. Mind and appearance are not two. This is Rinpoche's commentary. In Mipham Rinpoche's commentary, it's on page 30. Just under the root verse there. In the Tibetan, Chutamche Semsam Du Mikpa. It's on page 31, line 5 at the end. So that's what it means to focus on all phenomena as being mind only. It means that one is gradually coming to an understanding that all appearances are semnang nime, mind, appearance, as not being two different things. So at this point, there is definitely an appearance to which the focusing relates. One takes whatever one is experiencing as the reference point and analyzes that as being mere mind and appearance, or mind only. And she said there are some appearances that are pleasant and there are some appearances that are unpleasant, and on the basis of the pleasant appearances one gets attachment and suffers, and on the basis of the unpleasant appearances one gets aversion and suffers. And then there are indifferent appearances, and one even suffers because of those. This is the Greek commentary. So what does it mean here, this word application? It says one, it's an application involving something to focus on. Application means that one is using one's mind in such a way that one will connect up with the Dharma Dhatu. One will reestablish the connection, or how can we say, one will remove what is obscuring the genuine reality of ultimate mind. And therefore it's called application. And the same word, application, also has the sense of connecting up, uniting. The word has both senses in Tibetan. So since all of these phenomena that are appearing to oneself are only mind, and that is to say that they are only the projection of one's habitual patterns, then it is possible to realize their actual nature in the same sort of way that is possible to realize that the appearances in the dream are actually only one's own mind. So this is a, we could say, as it's presented here, it's a relatively easy step to take. It's the easiest of the four. It's because those and it, one has to try to capture the sense of this, how it could be thought of as being easy. It's because it's the processes of one's own mind. So it's possible to do something with that. And even though it's a deluded process, the whole thing is based on the patterns in one's own mind, and one can come to recognize what's actually going on in the same sort of way that one can recognize that one is dreaming. I mean, it's not an easy thing to do because of the habits involved, and because the things in the dream seem to really be appearing there, they seem to be objects existing on the outside, so one's attention is directed towards that. The attention is completely caught up in the beautiful park that one is walking through in the dream, whatever it is. So the attention, there's no attention left over, as it were, to realize that the park that one is experiencing is a dream. The attention is gobbled up by the park. The object completely tantalizes the attention, completely captures it. So there's not even a slight corner of that attention left to notice that it's a dream. And the same sort of thing happens in ordinary experience, in waking experience. But since the appearances are nothing else but the projection of the patterns of one's own mind, it is possible through training to see that they are appearance and mind inseparable, and therefore actually are just one's mind. And having done that, then one has a basis for the next step. Then the next step will more or less follow of itself, because based on that, then one is introduced into an application in which there is nothing to focus on, and that means no perceived object existing that could be focused on. So at this point, the process is starting to get less dualistic. One has already noticed that the appearances are dreamlike. So they are not taken to be perceived objects as such. They are not taken to be something actually there. So one is aware that there is nothing actually there to focus on. And this would correspond to, in the dream, knowing that it is a dream, and therefore knowing that the friends and enemies and the various things that are causing suffering in the dream are actually not there. And then, based on that, one then realizes, or one is able to apply one's mind to there being no focuser on which to focus. And that is to say, since there is no perceived object, then the one that the mind that is focusing on that perceived object is not actually there either. So, you know, if the awareness in the dream is focused on dream appearance, and that appearance, that object that is being experienced in the dream is not actually there, let's say it's an awareness of a flower, and there is no flower, then there can be no perception of a flower. You can't have perception of something if the something being perceived is not there. So in this way, the perceiver also is realized to be non-existent as a focus of attention. That there is no such thing as a perceiver towards which one could turn one's attention and actually find it. And Rinpoche said then, this is very difficult to realize the non-existence of the perceiver as such. But it's the next step after realizing there's no perceived. Then based on that, one will be able to apply one's mind focusing on that which is devoid of focus. So what that means is that one is able to focus one's mind on the suchness. So before, the attention was completely gobbled up by objects, and you couldn't even imagine anything else. Then at some point through training, you noticed that it was like a dream, that the objects were only your mind. And since they're only your mind, they're not really there as objects on the outside. And because they're not really there, the perceiver is not really there. And so the attention is then freed to focus on the emptiness of perceived and perceiver. So you see the logic of it, the way that it goes step by step in a completely natural progression. So that suchness in which there is nothing to focus on means that within the suchness, within the clear light nature of mind, that self-arisen wisdom, there is no dualistic appearance. There is nothing, there is an object to be perceived, and nothing there is a subject perceiving it, separate from each other. There is no separation between, there is no dualism of perceived and perceiver. And this is what is focused on. So this is actually, the mind is not just spaced out in some kind of a state in which there is nothing in particular happening. And Rinpoche said it at some point, wait a minute, no, it wasn't here, it's coming later. He said something about this, but we'll come back to it in at a later point. Not if the thing being focused on is free of anything to focus on. So it's a mimikpa mikpa, a non-referential focus. Yeah, well, it's playing with the words, right? Yes.
Not spaced out.
Yes.
Without any
dualistic perception involved. So it's something like during the meditation that we've been doing, the emptiers have been doing upstairs. Where we were told that one's meditating on the emptiness, but it's not just a dull and stupid state, right? Where one is just sort of sitting there like a cat, right? That there is something that the mind is actually balanced in, and that basic nature that one is balanced in there is free of any dualistic perceptions. There's nothing within it you could point to and say, oh, there's a thing having a substantial nature. Nevertheless, the mind is focused in, it's sharp, clear. Well, yeah. Yeah, sometimes the cat also is busy. That's when the cat is not meditating. In the cat's post-meditation state. On a mouse, yeah. Yeah, so Rinpoche said that what is important here in the beginning in terms of these four levels of application is what he calls ngeshe, which means certain knowledge, certainty in one's knowledge, which does not mean mere belief, not just blindly believing it. Ngeshe means that you have been through the process of listening and reflecting. You've heard many teachings on it, so you've heard it from many different angles, and you've been provided with the logical apparatus for analyzing it. And with that logic, you then reflect on the meaning of this again and again, and slowly come to a certainty that it is so. And when that certainty is there, then the more advanced steps of these four can actually be taken. So to actually get to the point where the mind is focused in on the suchness free of any focus would be a result of this certainty having arisen in one's mind. And because the certainty is there, one is able to meditate on it. Before the certainty is there, one is not actually able to meditate on in that way. But given that one is actually able to meditate like that, then what is it that is being meditated on? What is this mimikpe mikpa, this non-referential focus? In the Semsam tradition, the mind-only or Chittamatra tradition, it is the self-aware, self-luminous consciousness, empty of duality of perceived and perceiver. And for the Chittamatra practitioner, this mind is, as it were, really there. It's truly existent. So it's a kind of actual consciousness that one can find and then rest in. But for the Shinto Madhyamaka, empty of other middle path, this mimikpa mikpa, this ultimate level of suchness, is called Rongjun Yeshe, self-arisen original wisdom, or self-existing wisdom, self-present original consciousness. And this is not truly existent. Rinpoche said something about that. Did you catch the exact thing that he said there? The sense in which he made some sort of distinction there at that point.
He said that when they say exists, there is pain. Right?
That's it, yeah. And that was, I think he related it to the post-meditative stage, where one is using terms talking about it. But during the actual meditation, there are no terms. So it transcends being something truly existent. Yeah, if one were thinking that it was really truly existent. Then that if one is thinking that it's not just a way of talking about it conventionally, right? Then it was quite strong, and I didn't quite get the details. I'll have to try to get a hold of and then we can come back to that point tomorrow again, or whenever I get the threads straightened out. He also said, was talking about Nagarjuna in a Sangha, where Nagarjuna refers to the ultimate nature as being empty of any essence. And a Sangha talks about it as not being empty of an essence. And he related that to what he had just said about the Yajentong view. He said that even though it is said in the Shentong that this self-existent wisdom is truly existent, that it is truly existent without any substantial essence, that it has no essence, so it corresponds to the way that Nagarjuna described the ultimate. That's what I understood with what he said there. Yeah, from the Ngenren Jamsa. Yeah, he quoted, and it's a long quote. What's his name? Shakya Chokden Ngenren Jamsa Le Lung. De Yabo Topmasung. La. La.
Rava.
La re.
Re La re. La re.
So the important thing here is the explanation of the text as such. So we'll go back to that. So the commentary here ends off saying one should be aware that this is the way in which non-conceptual original wisdom is developed. The order of these corresponds to their progressive order of development in the mind stream, since it is easier to understand that outer objects do not have a substantial nature than to understand the more difficult point of there being no perceiver on which to focus, and so on, as has been taught in the samadhi wherein the appearance of heat is attained and elsewhere. So this first step of coming to see all phenomena as being mind-only is something accessible to us. It is something that that we are able to do and is therefore presented first, because in comparison with the others, it's easier. And once you've been able to take that step, then you would be able to go on to the others, and not before, to go straight to understanding the non-existence of the perceiver would be very difficult to do if one didn't start by first, say, looking at the phenomena as being mind only. So therefore, they are presented in this order and should be practiced in this order. And I remember when Rinpoche went to, he was giving a course in Sami Ling, in Scotland. Then he went over to Edinburgh for an afternoon and gave teachings over there. And someone asked, well, wouldn't it be possible to go straight to seeing that the perceiver doesn't exist? And Rinpoche said, it would be possible because people have different training in their background. So some might be able to go straight into understanding that even the perceiver is not existent, and then straight into the final one, right? That there is no duality of mind, and just rest straight in that. So it depends on your background, of how many of the steps you have to do. But generally speaking, it would be, one makes the whole thing easy for oneself if you start by looking at appearances as being mind-only. So that is, to say that, to call this application is another way of saying this is what you can do. This is the actual process of developing non-conceptual wisdom. This is what you do with your mind, how you use your mind and train it so that it will come out realizing non-conceptual wisdom, or to say it the other way, that non-conceptual wisdom will manifest for you. So we could say, in a way, that this is the most important verse in the text, since it tells you exactly what to do and in which order. As regards application, authentic in its mood, of engagement in this as well. Application involving something to focus on. Application involving nothing to focus on. Application devoid of focus, serving as focus. Application whose focus is nothing to focus on. The fourth is as follows. Here, the defining traits are introduced through three parameters vital to comprehension, because with respect to reposing in pure being, there is nothing of two and nothing expressible. And this is sublime repose in pure being. And because with respect to that devoid of appearance, what do as duality, formulation as such, as faculties, objects, principles of awareness, and as vessel-like worlds, appearances not exist, are consequently cases of no observation, no description, no ground, no appearance, no principles of awareness, no ground, which provides the criteria for the traits defining the non-conceptual original wisdom described as in the sutras. And because with respect to appearance, phenomena all as appearances equal the center of open space, since formations all are appearances like illusions. So this section is definitely not easy. And the commentary says, here the defining traits of non-conceptual original wisdom are introduced through three parameters vital to comprehension. And here the text sort of switches between calling this the defining traits of wisdom and the defining traits of pure being. Or maybe it's me who misunderstood it, but It seems to go with both, but at any rate, what is said directly in the text is talking about the defining traits of pure being, and it takes it from three different angles. One of them being the actual state of resting in that impure being itself. Then there's the defining characteristics from the perspective of the absence of appearances, and that means during the meditative equipoise, when there are no appearances. And the final one is when there are appearances, namely primarily during the post-meditative state. So we have to look at it from all three perspectives. And the commentary reads, because with respect to, and the because, we have a because here, because it starts out by saying there are three parameters vital to comprehension. Three parameters, that means three factors which you can measure this by in order to get to know it. And then because it said there are three, then it says because three times as we go down. Each of the becauses goes back to the fact that it said there are three. So the first of them is a description of actually resting in pure being. Because with respect to actually reposing in suchness, which is the pure being of all phenomena, there is nothing of a duality of perceived and perceiver. In addition, there is no split into two truths on the part of the intellect, and nothing expressible through any linguistic device or in terms of any theoretical conclusion. This is sublime repose in pure being, the ultimate case of which is the original wisdom of a Buddha. And here we go over and talk of this as wisdom. So it sort of switches between calling pure being, calling wisdom. The ultimate case of which is the original wisdom of a Buddha, which integrates the two truths in one inseparable taste, wherein these are beheld simply as they are, of which there is an approximation on the path of learning. So let's take that again. This first aspect, called reposing in pure being, refers to the unchanging aspect of ultimate mind. That one's mind is resting within ultimate mind, in which there are no changes. In a dream, because of the attachment to the appearances, the mind keeps changing its state. So if they're pleasant appearances, then it causes an attachment, which then leads on to something else, and it keeps changing. In ultimate mind, because there are no appearances in a dualistic way, then there also is no change of mind. So one is not changing between pleasant and unpleasant states, or being happy and sad, for example. If one is resting in pure being, it's not like a very happy state, a very happy state as opposed to a sad state. It's not an opposite of something. Because it doesn't involve any change, there are no opposites involved. There are no poles of positive and negative. And to speak of resting in pure being means that you are resting within the nature of your own mind. So Rinpoche said, you don't have to worry about somebody else's pure being. This state would be during meditative equipoise, but it's describing it from the perspective of the essence of it, or what it essentially is, right?
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the way it breaks it down, it takes it as three different steps. Where the second one is referred to as the meditative equipoise, where there are no appearances occurring. And the third is taken primarily from, you know, where there are appearances means mainly during the post-meditative state. And then it starts out with this first description, which is more or less a kind of description of the definition of it. You know, what sort of a thing is it to rest in pure being? But obviously one would only be resting in this during the meditative equipoise. So it goes together with the second one, but is sort of the general definition of it. And in fact, one couldn't really separate it from the post-meditative stage either. A realized bodhisattva who had... And here we're actually... What we're talking about here is realized bodhisattva. This is a description of the real thing. Right? Yeah, Rinpoche said that this first point, you know, the defining traits of reposing in the essence of pure being itself. Reposing in the essence means in that unchanging mind. In that very essence of mind which is completely non-dualistic and free of any change. It would correspond to Jurme Yongdrup. You know, in the... Well, this particular point doesn't analyze it from the point of view of appearance or non-appearance, but just says it's the essence of it. Which one then, as an experience, would mainly, how could we say, get in touch with during the meditative equipoise. But then if that meditative equipoise was a tonglam, if it was a meditative equipoise of a first bodhisattva level, then of course it would carry over into the post-meditative stage also. So that one would still be resting within pure being, but seeing appearances from that perspective. So it would be like the appearances experienced in a dream when you know you're dreaming. So what is this actual essence of pure being itself? And that is described as there is nothing of a duality of perceived and perceiver. That's the first characteristic. And in addition, there is no split into two truths on the part of the intellect. So, the fact that there is no perceived and perceiver means, Rinpoche, the way that Rinpoche talked about it there, at this particular point, was that it was no, there was no outer perceived object being experienced as something different from the inner perceiving mind. That these two were not being experienced as two. And that's a very tricky way to put it, because that could apply to either of the states that follows, either when one is experiencing appearances or not. In either case, there's no duality of perceiving perceiver. And because there's not that duality, there's also not an intellectual distinction made between the two truths. They are seen as inseparable, the ultimate truth and the relative. Because what is the relative truth? It is this duality of perceived and perceiver. And if one... The way the Tibetan goes here, you have to say, Zungzin ni... Yerme. The Yerme goes both with Dzungzin Ni and Denpo Ni. So perceived and perceiver are inseparable. They're not two. And because they are not two, then there's no intellectual distinction between two truths. It's only when they are split off and experienced as being two different things, perceived object as separate from consciousness, but then you get also the split into ultimate and relative mind. But without that split, then they are completely assimilated the way things appear would correspond with the way they are. There would no longer be, things would no longer be appearing as to and being assumed to be so. The Tibetan for this is Ni Nong Ni Shin, appearing as to and being taken as to. So you have to think again of the dream example. What does it mean they are not appearing as to? This would correspond to recognizing that you're dreaming, so that the friends and enemies and pleasant and unpleasant objects in the dream are not seen as something separate from your own mind. So there's no dualism in the appearance. And because there's no dualism there, then there's no actual, there's no relative truth as something separate from the ultimate truth. There's no relative truth because there's no friend there. There's no enemy there. There's no relative appearance to relate to. So that's the first extremely important, absolutely essential point here. If we have that clear, then the rest is not so difficult. The next is, you remember in the definition of phenomena, first things appeared as to, and they were assumed to be so. And then, because of that, one started to apply all the terms to them. And now we reverse the process. Since there is no split between perceived and perceiver, and therefore no distinction between the two truths, then also the terms that one could apply no longer apply. There is nothing to say about it. There is no term that could capture what is experienced there. Terms relate to specifically to the dualistic situation. Since we don't have a dualistic situation, then the various terminology, names that one could apply, do not apply. So it's called inexpressible. Jyotimepa. The inexpressible pure being. Jyotimepa. We'll go through this in Tibetan tomorrow afternoon. Then at this point, Rinpoche asked, well, if this is a state in which there is no dualistic appearance and you can't say anything about it, no terms apply, there are no conventions to use, then is it like sleep? Because sleep sounds like that kind of state. There's no dualistic appearance and you can't say anything about it. There's no, you know, while you're in that state, you would have no terms, right? You would be beyond, you would be out of terms. Be run straight out of terms. So is resting in pure being like that? You can probably guess the answer. It's not. And this is where the attempt to describe it goes over into such terms as self-existing wisdom, clear light, and so on. One is resting within that clear light nature. It is not a dark state. It is not a state of like of stupidity or dullness or just complete a blank out. Because you're resting in clear light, so it's a completely luminous state, not like sleep. So this is sublime repose in pure being, the ultimate case of which is the original wisdom of a Buddha, which integrates the two truths in one inseparable taste, wherein these two truths, are beheld simply as they are, of which there is an approximation on the path of learning. So again, we're talking about the type of state one would be experiencing in the dream while recognizing it is a dream. And only a Buddha does that completely and perfectly. What happens on the path of learning is only an approximation. It's something like it. And the path of learning means the entire Buddhist path from the path of accumulation, path of application, path of vision, path of meditation, all the way to the end of the mind stream of a 10th level bodhisattva. All of that is called path of learning, because until the end of the mind stream of the 10th level bodhisattva, there is still something more to be learned. And after the Vajrapani Samadhi, the Vajra-like Samadhi at the end of the 10th level, then there is nothing more to learn, and one has achieved complete Buddhahood. So then that is called the path of no more learning. So on all of these levels, from the path of accumulation all the way up to the end of the 10th bodhisattva level, and then that experience can then be further and further and further and further refined. So that concludes the section on the essence of resting in the essence of pure being. Then the next that follows is the case where there are no appearances. And because with respect to the attainment of that non-conceptual original wisdom, which is totally devoid of appearance, what do not exist in such a non-conceptual state are as follows. The appearance of the duality of perceived and perceiver. The process of formulation applied to that which appears as a duality and is assumed to be so by the conceptually oriented rational mind, which applies specifically determinative nomenclature to what appears in such a way, to what appears in such a way, to what appears dualistically. This formulative process being internal to and equivalent to the rational mind's conceptualization of percept and perceiver. So that's a bit of a difficult sentence. So let's go back and try to look at that again. Through achieving non-conceptual wisdom, which does not involve appearance, then there are a number of things that do not exist in that non-conceptual state. One of them is the conception, what do you call it? The perceptual process as such. And here we are talking about the state of meditative equipoise, in which there is no perceptual process going on. There are no forms, sound, smell, sights, form, sound, smell, taste, touch, or thoughts. And that is what is gone into in this point by point. The first of them said that there is no appearance of a duality of perceived and perceiver. So that could be interpreted in various ways. So it continues by saying that the whole process of terminology, of conventions, of applying names, which is normally done by the rational mind, has stopped. Not only have the appearances stopped, but the rational mind mind's functions have stopped. It's called Nangme Ying Su Nup. They have subsided into the non-dual expanse. And this, the reason why Rinpoche said, is this sleep, is because you could describe sleep in exactly the same sort of terms that the six consciousnesses, you know, the five sensory and the rational consciousness, dissolve into the all-based consciousness. So they noop, they subside, they disappear into the all-based consciousness, and then one is in deep sleep, and no forms are seen, no sounds are heard, and so on. And this state is exactly like that. That's why he started by making the distinction that this is not a stupid state like sleep, even though it has characteristics that resemble sleep very much. So then what else is it that doesn't appear? The inner faculties, that of the eye and so on. Outer objects, form and so on. The eye and so on means the eye, the ear, nose, tongue, and body consciousnesses, or body faculties. And objects means form, sound, smell, taste, touch. So to put it simply, there is nothing being experienced as an appearance. And there is no faculty to experience it, and there is no consciousness experiencing it. And that's the next one. The principles of awareness, meaning the eye consciousness, the ear consciousness, and so on, are not functioning. And vessel-like worlds appearances experienced in common. So during this meditative equipoise, one is not experiencing the world, the outer world. And that's obvious if none of the actual processes of consciousness are in operation, then one wouldn't be experiencing a world. All of which have in all aspects and every way subsided, which means they've gone down like the sun goes down. They've disappeared. As a result of which, not only are they not present, but what does appear is that one taste, which is the suchness, free of differentiation, referred to as the subsiding of dualistic appearance into emptiness. So this is specifically how it's different from sleep. One is resting within the suchness, free of any differentiation. Yeah. 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 It's waking up, in fact. So the whole dream of form, sound, smell, taste, touch, and the thoughts that one connects with that, and the things that one calls all of that, have all nooped. which is exactly the term for saying that one has recognized that it's a dream, so the whole dream sort of, the whole train of the dream sort of comes to a halt. And one is resting in that pure mind out of which all those appearances were originating. So this is the actual, this is actual enlightenment we're talking about. We've always wondered what it was Buddha was doing under that tree. The first step of it would be the first bodhisattva level. Yeah. No, it's not used in the same way that the Mahamudra term is used. There you have the whole Mahamudra path divided into the four yogas, where one of them is one taste. Right? It's not used in the same sort of way here. It's a way of talking about that there's no process of differentiation, you know, and because there's none of that, then there's no form differentiated from an eye consciousness, differentiated from an eye faculty, and so on. It's free of differentiation, so there's only one, there's a oneness about it. There's no manyness. But it's... Right? Well, I guess they would be gone for some time, yeah. Out for lunch. This must be the state that happens to some of the, you know, you read life stories of bodhisattvas mm-hmm. who go into samadhi for years. Mm-hmm. They don't need to eat and they don't need anything at all. They just... Well, you should ask Rinpoche that, I'm afraid. You need to ask an expert about that. I mean, usually, what I mean by samadhi when I meditate is something quite different. Yeah, how would they appear again? Yeah. Well, these are questions for Rinpoche, I'm afraid. You should write them down, and we'll ask for a question period at the end, maybe. Right? You should collect all the questions you have. How do they know it's the end of the
song?
Well, maybe they would. I mean, yeah, I've read life stories about this. Yeah. Yeah, there was a particular sound, at least in, I read the life story of a Chinese bodhisattva, which probably is pronounced different than it looks on the page, so I won't try to say his name. But he went into one of these samadhis that lasted for months, and he had just made some soup for some guests before he went into the samadhi. when he came out of it, the guests kept coming and coming, and he didn't come out of the samadhi. And so finally they used this sound, some sort of special sound that they apparently have agreed on, and which apparently could reach into the one in samadhi.
Coming out of the coma.
Well, in a state of coma or just deep sleep, then there would be no resting in suchness, right? In the non-differential state of mind. There's no waking up out of the dream into the nature of mind. No, I don't think that would be possible. It would be like forgetting who you are or something. And, I mean, this is your natural state, right? Well, maybe until you have final realization, but certainly after direct realization of it, when you actually saw it, you know, you don't actually. Yeah, but that's not but it's not realization. Once you have realized.
Yeah, I didn't say realize.
Okay, I guess glimpses you can forget because the dualistic habit is still stronger. You know, it's only at the...
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, this is like...
But if the dream you forget, you like forget yes. something that is just gone.
A consciousness and the kingdom of wisdom. So when the process of consciousness at this point has stopped, this is the end of it, at least on a rough level. This is a description of the first bodhisattva level. If it's the full and complete thing, but it doesn't mean that mind has stopped. Right? It just means the relative process of consciousness has stopped. And what comes out of that is wisdom. And the wisdom is able to perceive appearances. In the same way that, not in the same way, but it perceives appearances just as consciousness perceived them. The way is different. The way is original consciousness. You know, yeshi. Not just ordinary consciousness. Ordinary consciousness is namparshe, right? Consciousness of chunks, you know, nampas, little chunks, little images, bits, you know. Whereas yeshe, the original consciousness, is the sort of awareness you would have in a dream if you know you're dreaming. Where simultaneous with the experience of the appearance is also the experience of the emptiness of the appearance. So one is connected up with ultimate mind at the same time that there is an appearance. So the two never get split off from each other. You know, you don't get this dichotomy between relative and ultimate. And it would be a contradiction in terms to say to think that that wisdom would not be able to experience anything.
Okay.
Sentence, we're at a semicolon. And the sentence is very long, so maybe we better back up and start up with we're up at B. B is also in the middle of the sentence, but let's take it from there. And because with respect to the attainment of that non-conceptual original wisdom which is totally devoid of appearance, what do not exist in such a non-conceptual state are the appearance of duality perceived and perceived, the process of formulation, the inner faculties of the eye and so on, outer objects, form and so on, the principles of awareness, the consciousnesses, and vessel-like worlds, appearances, experience in common, all of which have in all respects and in every way subsided, as a result of which not only are they not present, but what does appear is that one taste, which is the suchness free of differentiation, referred to as the subsiding of dualistic appearance into emptiness. So there is something that appears in that state. It is not a state of stupidity or total darkness. Something appears, and what appears is the one taste, which is the suchness free of differentiation. So it's as we were saying just before, in connection with the four applications, that when you get to the fourth one, it's not just a blackout. The mind is focusing. Yeah? The mind is focused in on that which is free of focus. So these six just listed, and in the same order, are consequently cases of no act of observation on the part of the sensory consciousnesses. And then the note here says that act of observation is connected with the conceptual process, because the word used is takpa, which is related to, it's part of the same sort of word as in nampar takpa, namtok. So one has to understand that the very act of observing an object, the very fact of seeing a form, is subtly conceptual. So that even the word conceptualization is used as the term describing the act of observing something. And that, of course, gets lost in the English, because observation doesn't mean the same thing as conceptualization. And if we translate it as conceptualization, we lose the picture. Because what it's referring to is when your eye consciousness actually covers the form that it is going to see and perceives the ngowo of it. This is the way Rinpoche described this. Takpa here means eye consciousness covering the object and conceptualizing its essence, or not. It's not conceptualizing in a rough form, but it is a conceptual process in a way, because there's a certain act of measurement involved. You know, the eye consciousness is measuring off its object, and in doing so, it's excluding everything that is not that object, which is a subtly conceptual process. And normally, one speaks of the actual perception of a form by an eye consciousness as being non-conceptual. You know, the actual act where eye registers form is non-conceptual. But the basis for that non-conceptual registration of a form is a subtly conceptual act of perception. And it's because that act of perception itself is subtly conceptual that it stops at this point. All aspects of conceptuality in all of their degrees stops. And that's why one does not see any forms or hear any sounds and so on. Seeing forms and hearing sounds is part of conceptual mind. At least when it's connected up with the process of consciousness and is dualistic. Then the next thing that also happens is that there's no linguistic description. So one is not sitting in there in pure being thinking, oh, it's very dark in here, or it's very light in here, or it's very nice, or it's very, or I wish I could stay, or, you know, one is not putting any sort of labels on at all. It's a completely non-verbal experience. There is no support or ground for the incidence of consciousness. So there's no, the support or ground means the faculty of the you know, the sensory faculties, which are the ground on the basis of which the consciousnesses arise. There is no appearance, meaning no appearance of objects to be observed. No principles of awareness as observer, meaning the consciousnesses themselves, as well as no ground in the form of a vessel as the support for common experience, which provides the criteria for this presentation of the traits defining the non-conceptual original wisdom here described as the Tathagata has taught them in the sutras. For example, in the Mound of Rare and Supreme Jewels, a transmission requested by Kashyapa, which says, Kashyapa, so the Buddha is talking directly to him, what is called permanence is one extreme, what is called impermanence is another. So normally we've been taught impermanence is the is something to be developed as an idea. And in fact, even in the Sautrantrika system, impermanence is described as being genuine reality, the ultimate truth. But here it's being pointed out that impermanence is just another extreme in comparison to permanence. It's another conceptual classification. In that which exists, that which constitutes the middle between these two extremes, there is no analysis, there is no description. There is no support, there is no appearance, there are no principles of awareness, there is no ground. Kashyapa, this is the middle path and is called intimate discrimination of phenomena correctly applied. So this term analysis used here, where it says there is no analysis, is a synonym for the first one we had above, where it was called no observation. So there, the term analysis is again referring to the actual perception of an object. The eye consciousness analyzing the essence of an object, that is to say, it is covering that object, excluding everything else, and perceiving what makes that up, or it's the subject there, right? And we call it the area there. So that is called analysis. It's an analytical process, and therefore conceptual. And so each of these that are mentioned in this sutra quote correspond directly to the ones that were mentioned in the Chuninamji text here. Right? Above is called no observation, no description, no ground, no appearance, no principles of awareness, no ground. And down here in the sutra is called no analysis, no description, no support, no appearance, no principles of awareness, no ground. What is taught in the preceding is then related in a similar fashion. So the sutra goes on to relate this to self-entity and lack of self-entity, saying that self-entity is self is one extreme and lack of self is another. These two are also just ideas, conceptual classifications, and the middle between them is the one in which there is no analysis, no description, no support, and so on. The same for samsara and nirvana, and the same for existence and non-existence, where that which constitutes the middle between the two in each case is taught as being free of analysis and so forth as above. Hence, original wisdom devoid of appearance, which transcends the parameters defining appearance as described above, is itself the clear light. So now we have a very, very thorough description of what we mean by appearance. All of these factors that have been mentioned here, there are six factors involved. When those six are present, there is appearance. Now, when you have an observation, description, and so on. When they are not present, then what you are experiencing is clear light. Here it is referred to as, so it means this clear light, is referred to as non-conceptual original wisdom devoid of appearance, in which capacity it is equivalent to space, in that its own essence in being original wisdom transcending consciousness is not encompassed by any dimension whatsoever, whether that of the composite or non-composite, and so on. So any sort of conceptual category breaks down in the face of pure being. One cannot think of it in terms of anything composite. You can also not apply opposite concepts like non-composite and say it's a non-composite thing. It's transcendent. It goes beyond the process of consciousness, and the process of consciousness is the realm of concepts. As long as there is dualistic consciousness, there are concepts. As soon as there is no dualistic appearances, then the concepts no longer have anything to relate to, so they don't appear. Its essence, therefore, in not falling into the category of appearances, is pure being, which in being free of duality is self-contained illumination. This term, self-contained illumination, Rinpoche explained as meaning rongshinji ursangwa, that which is clear light by nature, or naturally clear light. If presented from the distinct perspective of that wisdom which realizes simplicity, without ever stirring from its depths, the wisdom associated with complexity sees all appearances as equal without mixing them, such that these two facets of wisdom cooperate as one whole without contradiction. Maybe. So there are two aspects of wisdom being talked about. It's not that there are two wisdoms. It's not they're not two yeshes, right? But this yeshe, this original wisdom, can be seen from two different facets. And the one of them, is the one facet, is called the wisdom which realizes simplicity. And that type of wisdom is the one that's resting within the essence of pure being. So without ever stirring from that simplicity of resting in pure being, then the other facet of wisdom functions. The wisdom associated with complexity sees all appearances as equal without mixing them. The former. The wisdom of complexity, without stirring from the depths of simplicity, wisdom, sees all appearances. Discussion that we had before about appearances. At this point, appearances are not a problem as they were before. Before, there was appearances were dualistic and therefore conceptual and therefore delusioned. At this point, the appearances are being seen from the perspective of the wisdom of simplicity. They're being seen by the wisdom of complexity. Both of these are wisdom. And Rinpoche compared this to the way appearances would be experienced in a dream if you recognize you're dreaming. So you would see all of the appearances. They would all be clear. They would not be mixed with each other. You could see clearly the appearance of a friend, the appearance of an enemy, and so on. But at the same time, one would not be taking these as something really existent separate from consciousness. They would be seen as appearance and emptiness inseparable. Such that these two facets of wisdom cooperate as one whole without contradiction. So the simplicity and complexity wisdoms are just two different aspects of the same wisdom cooperating without contradiction. So the fact that appearances are occurring now is not a problem. And in this way, it's different from the realization of the arhats, where they still have a problem with appearances. If one asks how this could be so, while no phenomenon ever wavers from equal taste in the depths of suchness, which is pure being, all host phenomena are nothing but appearances. So at this point, we're talking about appearances as semnang yime, appearance in mind, non-dual, or not as being two different things. So they are nothing but appearances. They are, the term in the Tibetan is they are exhausted as appearances, which could be understood either that they are finished being true, they're finished being experienced as being objects. So they're just seen as appearances now. Or you could think of it as that whatever is seen is simultaneously understood to be empty. So they're just empty appearances, like empty forms, hallucinations. The mirage, seeing water on a desert where there isn't any, and so on. And just as these two are not in contradiction, appearances, which are the self-manifestation of original wisdom contemplating pure being, manifest without hindrance. So here's the answer for why the bodhisattva would come out of this equipoise. Because appearances manifest without hindrance. There's nothing stopping them. Even though these do not exist as this and that objective focal referent. These appearances, right? These appearances that manifest do not exist as this and that, you know. It's not a cow as different from a flower, as different from a friend, as different from an enemy. It's not all this differentiation. There's not all of this and that. They are all equal. Friend is equal to enemy. Pleasant is equal to unpleasant. These appearances do not exist as this and that, objective focal reference. They're just the appearances of the mind seen as such. from which perspective your picture of absence of appearances presented above is complete, since the parameters of ordinary dualistic appearance with all its implications are hereby transcended. So at this point, people were pressing Rinpoche again and again to say whether their appearances are not. Right? I mean, we started out talking about the state in which there are no appearances. And here we're talking about the picture of absence of appearances presented above is complete through this description of the two aspects of wisdom, where appearances are seen as being of equal taste with suchness. So you can't really talk about them as appearances anymore, as such, right? Because there's nothing appearing. So Rinpoche ended up leaving it open whether there's any appearances being experienced or not, from our point of view. But certainly from the enlightened mind's point of view, there's no appearance, even though something might be appearing. I mean, it would be seen as the term is rongnong, right? Would be seen as the self-manifestation of the clear-line nature. Saying that word nangwa, which is being translated appearance, also means light. And is sometimes translated as light. So appearances are light, right? The light of the mind itself, right? Due to its astounding repercussions, this profound point has been more thoroughly elaborated on. It's almost an apology. So then we get to the third the third point of where there are appearances. So now we're going to contradict what we just said and say, now we're talking about appearances. And the text says, and because with respect to wisdom as associated with appearance, during meditative equipoise, now we thought we got past that point, right? But now we're still there. During meditative equipoise, all phenomena are of equal taste in that they have the essential non-referentiality of the suchness, that is to say, as appearances, they are totally equal, just like, for example, the center of open space. And this is a very enigmatic statement, right? So we're still in the meditative equipoise, and before we were saying there were no appearances within that, and now we're saying that all phenomena are seen as the non-referentiality of the suchness, that is to say, as appearances, they are totally equal, just like the center of open space. So somehow we are still talking about appearances, but not from the point of view of consciousness, ordinary consciousness, with all of its tinker toy, with faculties and consciousnesses and all its differentiation. But we're looking at appearances as being like the center of open space, which means, since open space has no outer boundary, it has no center. Yeah. We're seeing appearances as being like the center of open space, that is, as not being the center of open space. And you can't find the center of open space. Right? Appearances that would be experienced in a dream if you know you're dreaming. All of the usual reference points for the appearances would break down. And usually you would think of this is the appearance of an enemy, this is the appearance of a friend. But since one is seeing that they are both manifestations of clear light mind, then they are equal. The differentiation between them disappears. They are equal. And they are equal just like, for example, the center of open space. During the post-meditative state of such an equipoise, these, meaning these appearances, do not exist with a substantial nature, even though they appear, Since whatever may appear to such a wisdom, including all phenomena or formations without exception, are appearances like illusions, mirage, dream, and so on. So in other words, having gained this direct realization of pure being on the first Bodhisattva level, the whole process of consciousness has been transformed into wisdom, and anything that is experienced is seen immediately and spontaneously and simultaneously as being, appearance, and emptiness inseparable, like dreams and mirage and so on. You're no longer thinking, oh, this is like a dream. You're seeing it directly, that that's the way they are. The ultimate fusion, in which there is no differentiation between a meditative and a post-meditative state, occurs at the level of Buddhahood. An approximation of this occurs on the levels achieved by noble beings, and there is something bearing a partial resemblance to it in a mind stream where the symbolic wisdom of the mantric path has arisen due to profound skillful means. So we're saying that, you know, that ultimately there is no difference between the meditative and post-meditative state, only for a Buddha. But there is something like it for realized beings. And of course, the higher the Bodhisattva level, the closer the approximation would be. So there's less and less difference between meditative and post-meditative stages as you go up. But even for someone who has not gained the Bodhisattva levels, and this symbolic wisdom of the mantric path, of course, refers to the Vajrayana, secret mantra. And what it's referring to specifically, Rinpoche said, is the third initiation. In connection with the third initiation, various profound skillful means are given the practitioner to use, and through that a type of non-dual wisdom is experienced, which is described as symbolic wisdom, because it is not the real wisdom yet, but it is a symbol of it, it is an example of it, it is something like it. And through getting that taste of it, by following those instructions connected with the third initiation, then one is able to go on from there and get the real wisdom. So first you get the taste of it, and then you can get the real thing. So in that way, the mantric path gets one into the Bodhisattva levels quicker. So Rinpoche didn't go into the details of that, but he certainly explained more of it to us here this afternoon than he did when we were wandering around in India and Nepal and being bitten by leeches and on stomachs full of amoebas and everything, begging for the teachings. We didn't get as much explanation as he gave today. We're very lucky. This has been given somewhat elaborate consideration. Yeah, we didn't have to get a bad stomach and everything. Given somewhat elaborate consideration, since it is necessary to know this critically important point, treating of the lack of contradiction between these two procedures, namely, the ultimate way in which a Buddha sees, via the two aspects of original wisdom as associated with simplicity and complexity, and the meditative equipoise of the path of learning, where this is accompanied by the process of appearance, or is devoid of it. So again, the path of learning there refers to all of the paths except Buddhahood, from the path of accumulation up to the end of the mind stream of 10th level Bodhisattva, in which there is also the realization of suchness to a greater or lesser extent always relates to appearances, or to the lack of them. So because of that, all the way through that path of learning, there is a distinction between the meditative state and the post-meditative state. So that concludes the explanation that Rinpoche gave on this, plus the confusion we could add ourselves.